redemption. For perpetrators of abuse and assault in the Me Too movement, what should redemption look like? And is it even possible?
I don't think there will be redemption as long as the men involved are being judged by other men.
It depends. Those who have the conscience to recognize the wrongdoing of their ways actually have a potential to be a powerful voice of change.
Would I ever want them back in a position of power? Absolutely not.
I'm Sarah Gonzalez, one of the hosts of NPR's Planet Money podcast, and I'm filling in for Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. In the last few weeks, we've seen some prominent figures accused of sexual assault or other forms of abuse coming forward, looking to make a comeback, to come back to their former lives, their careers, their former positions of influence. In some cases, offering apologies, in others, explanations. The Takeaway's own former host, John Hockenberry, is one example. He wrote a lengthy essay published in Harper's Magazine, basically saying his career has been unfairly taken away from him. He seemed to criticize his alleged victims while arguing that he deserves a second chance. Meanwhile, other prominent men accused of sexual harassment, comedian Louis C.K., is back on stage. Former Today Show host Matt Lauer says he has a comeback in the works. The list is growing. And every one of these public resurfacings leaves us wondering, what does it take to come back from a public fall? A fall that's based on accusations of assault or abuse. And should the public give these people a second chance at all? It's a fitting question today. It's Yom Kippur, the Jewish Day of Atonement, centered around repentance.
Hopefully over the last month or more, Jews have been taking stock of who they've been over the last year and making right any wrongs that they need to make between themselves and the people in their lives.
That's Rabbi Danya Ruttenberg, a rabbi in residence at Avodah and author of Nurture the Wow.
Today is the day to take all of that repentance work, both between ourselves and others and between ourselves and the divine, and to offer it up and to ask for absolution and atonement.
I asked her what we can learn from her faith about what it means to make right what you've done wrong.
The Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, only works in our interpersonal sins, in our interpersonal mistakes, if we've already made it right with the other person. First of all, you need to acknowledge the harm that you've done, ideally publicly. And then you need to do some repair work, some amends work. What can you do to right the harm that has been done to the person that you harmed? Are you paying somebody's medical bill? Is there some sort of reparations? Is there volunteer work you can do? Something like that. And then you need to do a lot of deep internal, hard transformational work to become the kind of person who does not do that harm anymore. And somewhere in there, there's an apology, a sincere apology to the person that you've harmed, but it must be coupled with the work of transformation, of becoming the kind of person who is able to make different choices the next time.
Wow. So that sounds like a process that could take a while. From your perspective, have any of the high-profile men accused of sexual assault or harassment attempted to follow some of these steps?
No.
No.
I have been looking. I have been waiting. I've had all signals open to try to see somebody doing what we would consider sincere repentance work. And I haven't really seen it. There have been a lot of public statements, pretty much all of which have fallen short of even the first step of this repentance process, right? All of these statements are like, I'm so sorry to have hurt my fans. I feel so ashamed. The impact has been on my family, and not taking full responsibility for the harm they caused and centering the victims. There's been really sort of half-hearted first steps, and I haven't seen anybody who's done anything that looks like it might be a second step.
And what do you make of their attempts to reestablish their status? I mean, that is essentially why they are asking the public to forgive them, I guess, in a sense. And I'm thinking here about like Louis C.K. trying to return to stand-up and Matt Lauer telling fans that he would be back soon.
Right. First of all, the only person that can forgive a perpetrator is the victim. So the idea that we have in American culture that the person who's done the harm to a specific person can then go ask the public at large for forgiveness and that that's going to somehow fix their harm doesn't work in Judaism. We have really clear ideas about how this works, and the general public is not in a position to absolve this person. It's the victim and God are the only two actors in this scenario. And yeah, the idea that people are running right back to a paycheck, to fame, to glory, to attention, and to put themselves right in the same situations that caused them to make it so easy to commit harm in the first place raises all of my red flags.
Speaking of victims, I want to talk to you about John Hockenberry. He is the former host of The Takeaway, who was accused of sexual and racial harassment by multiple women who worked on this program, as well at least one contributor to the show. He published an essay last week defending himself. And in that essay, he wrote, quote, "Only one of my accusers reached out or responded to my heartfelt queries. She had very useful and meaningful things to say, for which I am grateful." He seems to be upset with his victims for not responding to him. And what are your thoughts on that?
I think he needs to ask some questions about who has what kind of obligations in this scenario. In Judaism, anyway, the obligations and the work is really on the perpetrator. Victims don't necessarily owe the perpetrator anything. They've already suffered. That's enough. If someone who's a victim is willing to engage with a perpetrator and to help them understand and to do some emotional labor and to engage with them, that's very generous of them. But at least in my tradition, they're not obligated to.
I'm curious what you think about how law plays into religion here. Like, if you were to admit to your Jewish leaders that you sexually assaulted someone, but you never faced the criminal consequences, I think it's harder for the public to forgive you, right?
Again, I'm much less interested in public forgiveness, but certainly in my tradition, the repentance process requires the person who has done harm to accept the full consequences of their actions. And so part of the repentance process can involve the victim choosing to forgive their perpetrator, but it can also, in the exact same scenario, involve the perpetrator going to jail because that's a consequence of their actions. Or it could involve a perpetrator losing their career and their status and their sense of public adulation. And being able to accept that with humility is part of how we understand what repentance is.
Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh has also been accused of sexual assault, an incident that Christine Blasey Ford, the woman accusing him, says took place decades ago when they were both teenagers. Kavanaugh is fully denying the accusation, but it's also led to a debate about whether people should be held accountable for things that they did as teenagers. Does Jewish law have anything to say about that?
You're a person and you have an action. And the fact that in American law, there's some sort of magical thing that happens at 18 to change your status doesn't change the fact that you as a human being did something harmful a year before that. So I personally don't think the age matters at all. What matters is whether or not the person has done the work of repentance. And for Kavanaugh to be denying these allegations certainly gives us no indication that that's at all in process. You know, if nothing else, we would need to, from a Jewish lens, slow this down and get some facts about what happened. But the fact that some time went away and you didn't never said sorry and you never acknowledged the wrong that you did and never tried to do anything to repair it, time is not a magical fixer.
And then moving forward, Rabbi, I'm not sure that we can expect many men to go through all of these steps toward atonement that you mentioned earlier. But what are some preliminary steps that you'd like to see in terms of how society responds to incidents of sexual misconduct?
I would like for us all as a society to start taking victims seriously. What I really love about my tradition is that it centers the victim and their needs, and that there is emphasis on the fact that the perpetrator can understand that the harm they have done is serious and they can understand the impact they've had and that they can change and grow. But it's not automatic. And there's just a lot of work that has to happen.
And if there are men out there listening who really do want to atone for acts of sexual abuse or harassment, is there anything that you want to say to them?
Thank you. Please, I'm very grateful if you're willing to really look within. Start not by going to the victim. There are questions about re-traumatizing victims and how you can do that in a way that's going to be appropriate. Start with therapy. Start with owning your actions to the people in your lives. Start with asking for help. Start with owning who you are so that the people in your life can help you to become someone who is better. And then start to look around and figure out what kinds of amends and repair might be necessary.
Rabbi Danya Ruttenberg is a rabbi in residence at Avodah and author of Nurture the Wow. Rabbi, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're also hearing from lots of you about whether redemption is possible for people guilty of sexual misconduct. And if so, what it should look like.
Hi, this is Bethany in Frisco, Texas. What do we mean by redemption? I don't think they need to be publicly flogged. I think it's fine for them to lead a quiet life out of the spotlight with whomever in their life chooses to forgive them. But I don't think they have any right to public forgiveness or to their old careers and level of respect. Too many women have been crushed and kept out of the spotlight by these mostly men, and they didn't get any kind of statute of limitations on their suffering or career setbacks. Why should their attackers get one for their crimes?
Hi, this is Hassan. I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. Seems to me everyone's done something they're not proud of. This goes for those caught up in the Me Too movement as well. I would assert we need to reach a consensus as a society on what past actions can be forgiven and what cannot be forgiven.
My name is Frances Arujo from Providence, Rhode Island, and here are the things I think a man needs to do to get back into people's good graces. Admit wrongdoing, apologize, contribute to a woman-oriented charity, and never, never, never do what they did again.
This is Byron. I'm calling from Gary, Indiana. First of all, they need to own up to what they did and apologize for it. People just want to hear that you're sorry for what you did. They want to hear you apologize. They want to hear you accept the consequences of your actions.
This is Julie Bailey from the Bronx. And I'm sure that there is a road to redemption for those indicted, but it would be nice if these men waited a little bit longer than it takes to birth a baby before pushing themselves back out on us. Give us a minute to figure it out.
Thanks for giving us your thoughts. You can also join the conversation about redemption and Me Too on our Facebook page or tweet us at The Takeaway. This week, the Trump administration announced another round of tariffs, this time on $200 billion worth of goods imported from China. We're talking about a list of nearly 6,000 items ranging from foods and cleaning products to mattresses and makeup. Our producers checked out the list.
Shampoos,
butter,
anchovies,
bird's eggs,
insecticides,
paints and varnishes,
preparations for permanent waving or straightening the hair,
sardines, mackerel, jack and horse
mackerel, dryers for boysenberries,
cashew apples,
misters of mercury,
tilapia, catfish, carp, eel, nile perch, snakehead, including misters of foundation, including ruin, nuts, cashew, snowflakes, dried date, natural honey, strawberries, natural
honey. The list of Chinese goods affected by the new tariffs is 194 pages long, and they go into effect next week. They start at 10% and bump up to 25% in the new year. China quickly retaliated with its own tariffs on $60 billion worth of American goods. It's the latest in a swiftly escalating trade war between the two countries. Here to help us understand what this means for you and us as consumers is Amber McKinney. She's the assistant managing editor for Law 360 and co-host of Pro Se Podcast, and she oversees coverage of international trade. Amber, thanks for being here with me.
Thanks, Sarah. Great to be here.
As we just heard, there are a ton of things that will now be subject to tariffs. So come September 24th, I walk into a pharmacy or a Walmart or a Home Depot. What's different? Will consumers feel this right away?
I want to start by saying that the numbers here are so big and the list so long that it almost starts to feel like a fairy tale we're all talking about or something really that just seems pie in the sky that's hard to understand. But these are goods, the new tariffs are on goods that everyone buys. So it's important to understand that It's not China writing us a check and handing it to the U.S. Treasury. Importers are the ones that are going to pay the price for these. So that's Walmart or Target or Ford when they buy parts to put into their cars. And what happens is that either those retailers and manufacturers have to basically eat the increase in costs, or more likely, they pass it on to you when you go to buy those products.
Is there any way to measure how this will affect, say, the average household?
Well, critics of these tariffs say that you should really brace as a consumer for a big uptick on stuff you buy every day. I mean, as this the open of this segment showed us, it's everything. It's seafood. It's your toothbrush heads. It's a refrigerator that you need to replace in your kitchen. So it's a lot of things that are concerning for the average person. The National Retail Federation sent a letter ahead of when these tariffs were put in place, saying it would impact prices on just about everything. So consumers are really going to feel it.
And in the first round of tariffs on Chinese goods, the Trump administration deliberately tried to sort of minimize the impact on American consumers. We weren't supposed to really feel the tariffs. They didn't really target our everyday products. This round is clearly different. But there are some Chinese items that were taken off of this list. What kinds of things are exempt from tariffs and why?
So we did see that there was about 300 items out of that thousands on the list that were proposed and then taken off when this final list came out. It was stuff like smartwatches. It also included some things like baby carriages and some safety items, some bicycles, stuff like that. So it was consumer items, but it's a little unclear exactly why they were taken off. Apple did complain quite a bit about things like their smartwatches, and that ended up off the list. And also, there's some idea that maybe a bit of this was that the tariffs are taking effect right before the holiday shopping season. Mm. So a few of these consumer goods fit into that bucket, and they're not currently on the list. But I just want us all to keep in perspective that it's 300 items off the list of thousands. So even though some were taken off, it's not a big saver for the average consumer.
Amber, the tariffs on $200 billion worth of goods comes on top of another $50 billion in tariffs already. So at this point, half of all Chinese imports to the United States are affected by tariffs. What does this mean?
Yeah, it's a wild time for trade right now. So we already had some tariffs on washing machines, solar panels, aluminum and steel, and those were tariffs on all countries. Then we've moved to these China-specific ones, and like you said, it's about half of our trading relationship with China at this point. And Donald Trump has repeatedly threatened to make it essentially everything from China. He said over and over again that if China retaliates about these tariffs, then he's going to impose even more and basically bump it up to the maximum. And what we've seen is that China has kept pace in kind. So they're also very close to the maximum of the goods that we export into China. So we really have basically the highest escalation of these tensions that's possible.
Right. So Trump has said that if China were to just treat the United States fairly, this tit for tat would end. But it really seems like Trump is telling China, like, don't even think about responding with your own tariffs, right?
Yeah, and they have responded with their own tariffs. No one seems to be backing down. At this point, it's sort of a who's going to blink first kind of scenario. What we could see, there have been talks. There were some about 6 weeks ago or so between China and the U.S. We could see a revisiting of that, but we haven't seen any real progress being made. So it's very unclear how this is going to get resolved.
And we know that Trump is already threatening another $267 billion on Chinese goods. What is the larger picture? Is there any way to predict how this might play out 5 to 10 years from now?
It's really tough because there's a lot of debate about how exactly these tariffs will play out. Some U.S. companies will try to find supply routes that aren't through China. That might help a bit. But then there's others that say they can't. Right the second I have my hair pulled back with an elastic hair tie, and I bring that up because Goody, the company that makes those, is just one example, has said they can't move their production from China. It's just impossible. So you're going to have companies that face that problem as well.
All right. Amber McKinney is the assistant managing editor for Law 360. Amber, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Before Hurricane Florence made landfall last week, the Takeaway took inventory of the gaps in disaster planning for those who can't evacuate their homes and cities, those vulnerable populations who lack the resources to relocate in advance of major storms or who are hampered by disability or chronic illness. We spoke last week with Mark Burtis, a former director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management for Shelby County, Ohio, and an emergency management consultant about some of these issues.
We have finite resources in this country for evacuation. If we need to evacuate someone from a long-term care facility or a hospital who's medically vulnerable, it's just dangerous to even consider moving some people who are on long-term medical devices and attached to the need for power or clean water for dialysis.
Just some of the challenges to consider for more vulnerable residents ahead of a storm. Well, today we're checking in to see how one community of people did fare in the wake of Florence. For that, we head to the rural town of Kinston, North Carolina, population 21,000, where many are elderly and low income, and the authorities have difficulty helping people evacuate their homes. Anna Kinsey is the director of community development for the Kinston Community Health Center in North Carolina. Her organization has been in the thick of helping those in need before, during, and after the storm. Anna, welcome.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Anna, before the storm hit, who were you most concerned about? Who were you planning for?
We were concerned about the people, the elderly people, of course. We're always concerned about the elderly people and making sure that they're getting to the resources. But we were actually concerned about those that, the ones that we're talking about that live in the country, that have barriers to start with before even the storm arrives or any storm arrives, with transportation, getting to medical facilities and getting to food and things like that.
And how is your community doing right now? How are you guys faring?
We're doing okay now. We have a lot of displaced people, and there's, I think from the last count that I was given yesterday evening, there's about 550 people in our main shelter here in Kinston. And the amazing thing is they're not only from Lenoir County, they're from all the surrounding counties as well. But we've actually pulled together, and I think that we learned from Matthew, and our community is doing very well, trying to get the resources out to people that need it, providing food to people that are misplaced out of their homes. And right now we're actually trying to help people find hot showers and hot meals, because there's still a lot of people without electricity and water.
And you said you learned from Matthew, the last hurricane. What did you learn?
We weren't as prepared. Everything was a lot different this time. We had actually 2-3 days to get ready, and organizations didn't have that in Matthew. And so there was a lot more people that were not able to get to the shelters and were not able to get rescued out of their homes when the flooding started. And we have people, it's just amazing. You ride down the road and you see people from New York is one of them. You see people from other states that have come here to help us. And we didn't have that before, not until after, you know, Matthew had hit. And this time people came before Florence came. So we were more prepared this time.
And are you out of the woods? Has most of the danger passed?
Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. And that's the bad thing. People are going to work like normal, you know, like a normal everyday happening that before Hurricane Florence. But really, we're expecting the river to crest. I think they're expecting it to crest on Friday. And so we're waiting. And the bad thing about it is several of us were standing at the window yesterday, and it was beautiful. The sun was shining and you could not even tell there was anything that happened.
So what is your greatest need right now, Anna?
Well, right now it's getting food to people. And like I said, and I really want to stress this, Sarah, that our community has learned from Matthew. So it's amazing how all of us are coming together and helping each other. Our churches are helping with the first responders and serving food and shelter for them to come and just rest. The rest of the churches in our community are trying to get food out to people. But the flip side to that is that these churches have the food, but sometimes they're not able to get it to the people. And that's one of the issues, because we are so vulnerable here because we're rural. It's hard to get help to the people that's out there. And you could see messages on Facebook and people calling in trying to get to the local EMS saying, you know, I'm here, nobody's found me, and I'm flooded in my house, and I have kids, and that's the issue. It's not that we don't have the resources, it's just we can't get to them. We don't know where everybody is.
And so do you feel like you've been able to reach the vulnerable people in your community?
I feel like we've done it better than Matthew. I feel like we learned from what happened to us and Matthew, and like I said, communication is a key, and they were, the local EMS and the DOT, they were on top of this. And we have, I think we had an organization that actually went out, I think it was called Community Feeding a Community. They actually went out on foot throughout our community to get to those people and let them know about the potential flooding and about Florence coming. And I think they're still out there now because there's a lot of people we can't reach. We take advantage of having a cell phone and, you know, TV, thinking we're going to have that all the time, when in all actuality, we have a lot of elderly and people in our housing developments here in Kinston that don't have phone lines.
And how worried are you about those people that you have not been able to reach yet? What are the risks?
Well, what are the risks? Well, there are many risks. I mean, there's sickness, there's death, there's diseases that can be in the water. They have one of our areas here, they have actually put an announcement on a couple days ago. And, you know, they the residents, if they're in their homes, they have to boil the water, you know, because the waters, there's so many different diseases that can be in the water. And they're scared that they don't want people to drink that water because a lot of people don't have water. So they're going to places. I talked to one of our patients yesterday. And she told me, she said, Anna, she said, I had to go out into my ditch and get some water. I don't have any water. And, you know, it's things like that. They can get very sick, very ill from that.
And what more do you need right now for the elderly, the sick? What do you need?
Well, I'll tell you, we need more food. I know people are right now, they're even talking, churches are getting ready for, you know, they're trying to get the word out there for crisis cleanup afterwards. For recovery efforts, they're trying to get the cleaning supplies, they're trying to get donations for that, for the non-perishable foods, toiletries, because there's so many people without right now. So we need donations like that coming in.
All right. Anna Kinsey is the Director of Community Development at the Kinston Community Health Center in North Carolina. Anna, thank you for your work and good luck.
Thank you, Sarah. Bye-bye.
All this week, Kenzina Vega is in Puerto Rico, reporting on how attitudes on the island have shifted since Hurricane Maria. Today, she brings us an interview with a controversial figure who's been fighting for Puerto Rico for 5 decades.
One way to describe Puerto Rico's relationship with the United States is complicated. Historically, Puerto Ricans have considered two options for the future status of their island: statehood or the status quo. But one thing we hear less about is independence, including the Puerto Ricans who have long fought back against American colonization. And one of the most well-known and controversial figures in this fight is Oscar Lopez Rivera.
I cannot accept colonialism. I will fight colonialism until my last breath.
Even in New York, which has one of the largest populations of Puerto Ricans outside the island, emotions ran high on whether and how to honor Lopez Rivera during last year's annual Puerto Rican Day parade. To many, Lopez Rivera is an icon, a freedom fighter, and a former political prisoner. To others, he's a terrorist. Rivera was a member of the Fuerzas Armadas de Liberación Nacional Puertorriqueña, the FALN, a leftist paramilitary organization that fought for Puerto Rican independence from the United States. And the group was responsible for setting off more than 120 bombs nationwide in the 70s and 80s. In 1981, Lopez Rivera was arrested and charged with seditious conspiracy against the United States government and sentenced to 55 years in prison, which was later extended to 70 years. 12 of those years were spent in solitary confinement. Then, in 2017, President Obama commuted Lopez Rivera's sentence. He was released just prior to Hurricane Maria, and he says he's never stopped working. I sat down with Lopez Rivera in his office for a one-on-one conversation, and we began by talking about the responsibility of the Puerto Rican diaspora in fighting for the future of the island.
Puerto Rico has to be the promised land for all Puerto Ricans. At this particular moment, what we need most is the help that they can give Puerto Rico, because We faced a crisis that I had hoped I would never see in my life.
What crisis are you referring to?
The crisis is the conditions in Puerto Rico. We're not creating any jobs. The school system is completely collapsing. Cost of living in Puerto Rico is higher than in the United States.
How important do you think our relationship to the United States is right now?
Well, the United States has never really cared about Puerto Rico. There's no sign for 120 years showing us that the United States really cares about Puerto Rico. The only thing that the United States cares is to continue exploiting the hell out of Puerto Rico. Historically, it has not done anything. If we look at what has happened in Puerto Rico for 120 years, and a lot of people do not know this, but we have been used for the worst experiments that anyone can imagine. We have suffered the worst pollution that anyone can imagine. If we look at how Puerto Rico's used, how Puerto Rico got into a debt of $74 billion, we don't know. But the United States government, who should be doing the work, the fiduciary work, and holding people responsible, because we don't have the power to do that.
And we don't have the power because?
We're a colony. People don't understand what colonialism really is. Colonialism takes every power from the colonized. Historically, we have not been allowed to really, really develop our human resource to a maximum and use the human resource that we develop. A good example is when they privatized the hospitals in Puerto Rico, many of the doctors lost their jobs because privatization is a question of making money. It's not about providing medical services. So once that happens, the patient becomes a commodity. When we look at the infrastructure, the conditions of the hospitals in Puerto Rico, and they were privatized, those hospitals were not in shape to deal with the conditions created by Maria. But they were not in shape to deal with the conditions, period, before Maria. So we are talking about neglect. We're talking about irresponsibilities. We're talking about crimes. We're talking about ugly, ugly crimes. Because if we look at the number of people who died after Maria, those are crimes. In a colonial situation, the options are very, very, very limited. I'll give you a good example. We talk about renewable energy. If we use solar power, we have enough solar power to make Puerto Rico completely self-sufficient in energy. But they don't see it because they don't know it. So it takes a while. We need to create examples, show them that it's viable and that it can be done. So not knowing the potential that is there, it affects us because we need for the people to know exactly what the potential is, to feel the strength, to feel, hey, I can do that, I can use it, I can work with that, and this is a solution to the problem.
I feel like I'm starting to hear that from people here, where they're saying, you know what, we knew the United States wasn't going to help us, we didn't have a lot of faith in our local governments here in Puerto Rico, so we said, let's do it ourselves.
Yes, yes.
And there seems to be, now this could also be just the first year after Maria, where, you know, there's still a lot of emotions running high and people are still feeling very energized politically. But there does, at least now, appear to be a sense of, we got this, we're going to build it, we're Puerto Ricans, you know, vamos a ayudar, we're going to help each other, right?
Yes, yes. I think there is. The cleanup in Puerto Rico is done by Puerto Ricans. A lot of the work in my hometown in San Sebastian, the mayor of San Sebastian, he took all the retired workers from the energy company and said, we're going to wire this thing, we're going to have electricity. And he did. So what you're saying is very, very true. People feel confident of the work. They've done it, and they know how to do it, and it's great.
But is that leading to, do you see this being a new movement, a sustainable movement of Puerto Rican what? Independence? Because I know that was, you know, really the focus of your work. And we want to talk a little bit about whether you think that your work was effective or not, ultimately. But Is this the beginning of something new? And if so, what is that in your eyes for the Puerto Rican community?
I think that we have to take this moment and run with it. People don't have the confidence yet to say we can do all. And we need to inculcate that into people's head, you know, that all it takes is to think that it is possible, doable, and it can be done. The thing that I emphasize most is that when we talk to Puerto Ricans, the majority of Puerto Ricans love being Puerto Rican. When I talk to Puerto Ricans, they love the Puerto Rican culture, love our national identity, language, and our way of life, because we are a happy people. So I think that the challenge is, where does that love take us? And I think that if we have love for Puerto Rico, the love that we have then has to manifest itself in the decolonization process. I believe that Puerto Rico has the potential of being a self-sustaining nation.
How, though?
Well, simple.
How?
I'll give you a good example. An independent Puerto Rico will give us 9 to 12 miles of seawater. The fishing industry in Puerto Rico, people who fish in Puerto Rican waters are not Puerto Ricans because we don't have the equipment. But we can do it. We can take that water and we can create the cooperatives and be almost self-sustainable just with the fish. Hawaiians do it. And Hawaiians have the fishing ponds. We can do the same.
Hawaii is now a state, though.
Yeah, but we can do what we know best. And we know how to fish. We know the waters. If we're told that we cannot do it, we are not allowed to do it. And that's the problem. We're not being allowed to do what we need to do. So I'm saying to you, I'm saying to everybody that we can do whatever needs to be done to be self-sustainable.
So politically, do you think there is a future chance with this momentum? And you said if people grab on, and I'm going to think both in the mainland diaspora and on the island, if they take advantage of this moment, you honestly believe that we could be headed towards independence?
Yes.
Is that realistic? Yes.
Well, I don't know how realistic things are, but I'm always hopeful. Independence has to be total independence. Independence has to be something where people really, really participate. The idea of struggling for independence is a struggle where the people have to be engaged in every aspect of life. It is when people are being denied the ability to feel that power. And one of the things in Puerto Rico is the idea of dependence was cultivated so deep as part of the colonization process that people started believing that they could not do things independently. The only thing that is impossible in this world is that doesn't get done. And if we work at it, if we have the courage and the strength and the guts to really work and say, we can do it, we can do it.
When you look at what happened, there are people that think you're a hero, there are people that will criticize you and say that you're a traitor. When you look at your work, your history, and you look at where we are today, do you think what you did was worth it? Would you do it again? I mean, because you did a lot. You know, that was 12, 13 years in solitary confinement. You were accused and convicted of certain activities with the U.S. government, of conspiracy to overthrow. I mean, those are not small things. Mm-hmm. Was it worth it when you wake up today and say, here's where we are in Puerto Rico?
Well, I think that the work and what we did and what I did allow us to see that we can do a lot of things. Now, would I do the same thing that I did before? Experience tells me. If you make a mistake, don't repeat it. For me, it's not only a struggle for the independence of Puerto Rico, but also for a better and more just world. And I'm willing to pay the price. There's no doubt in my mind about that either.
That's Oscar Lopez Rivera, a longtime Puerto Rican independence nationalist and former political prisoner.
And you'll definitely want to tune in tomorrow. Tanzina and other members of the Takeaway staff have been in Puerto Rico talking and reporting on issues around the island. And so the Takeaway is bringing you a special hour all about Puerto Rican identity in the wake of Hurricane Maria.
It's a process of recognizing yourself as someone with power in your own life and someone powerful that is being oppressed.
The Puerto Ricans, we recovered. We didn't stay at home crying. I'm very proud to be Puerto Rican.
Puerto Rican culture is transnational. So we have Puerto Rico, but we have Puerto Rico everywhere.
That's tomorrow on the show or in your podcast feed. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Sarah Gonzalez in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway's coverage of Puerto Rico is supported in part by the Puerto Rico Relief and Rebuilding Fund of the Partnership for New York City, funder of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Puerto Rico, established 50 years ago and servicing 14,200 children and youth in 13 clubs around the island. Learn more at bgcpr.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.